My name is Warren. I am the co-founder of 33 Shake, along with Erica here. We're a specialist endurance sports nutrition company. I'm an amateur endurance athlete. I've run 35 or more ultra marathons, and as part of the abuse of the training that I got from that, I gravitated into cycling because it really takes a lot of load off and helped me keep my training load going. And having been an avid BMXer as a kid, the cycling thing fitted quite naturally. It's grown ever since then. I'm also absolutely a 44, a midlife cyclist, so I guess I'm on point for the demographic here. And I was, before all this, a journalist. I used to write originally about motorcycles, as Phil said, in the days when I was racing them and we were both falling off those. And then gravitated to writing for most of the papers and fitness magazines as I got more into fitness, wide range of subjects. And that began the journey that created 33 Shake, because it's kind of 2008, 2009. Erica's doing a lot of triathlon, I'm doing a lot of ultra marathon and cycling. Through the journalism, well, I'm warm that far, I hope you guys are warm. If anyone smells burning, let me know, it's my jeans. But I was doing a lot of these races, and as a journalist, nutrition companies are very keen to help out. They offer their scientists, they offer their nutritionists, they offer their product. And yet I could never shake the same problem: stomach trouble, illness, poor immune function, energy levels that shot up and then ramped down again. I didn't have a stable energy base to work from. And I never enjoyed the products. The taste was disgusting. And yet every so-called nutritionist and expert was giving me the same recipe. So it began a sort of an exploration between Eric and myself and a couple of other partners to see, could there be a better way out there? And that's something we'll come to a little more in the talk. But there will also be a chance for you guys to sample our products. I know a lot of you have already given Erica your emails. If you'd like the samples, as well as a video of this talk and a full set of my slides, please do make sure Erica's got the email and we can send that all out to you. We don't do any spam, and if at any point you don't want any email from us, there's a massive unsubscribe button on every single one. You can never hear from us again. So, that's the admin covered. Here's me before I came to CycleFit. I mean, you can just see, in fact, hobo on wheels is the caption there. I'm trying, but really there's a lot going wrong. It's pre-33 Shake. I have a bottle of I do not know what on the down tube there. I'm using a running rucksack, a mountain biking helmet, motocross gloves, and thermal underwear. Fortunately, I was lucky enough to stumble into this little oasis one day, and look at the difference they made. All of a sudden, the world's best were queuing up for my advice, or maybe just to stop me falling over. That is actually a real photo. It was one of the last journalism gigs I did, and certainly Mr. Cavendish did not disappoint, and he did beat me in a downhill race on the Isle of Man. Anyway, what's the goal of this talk today? The first thing is to remove the confusion around sports nutrition, unpick it to a point where it can really make sense for everybody, because truly, it's really not that complicated. Even though a lot of people would like to make it complicated, because that makes money. And to give you guys simple, actionable strategies for a performance and a health upgrade. Because these things are linked. You don't have great performance without great health. That's something we'll look at a little bit later on. And the place we're going to start at, we'll also have a Q&A at the end, sorry, as well. So any questions you've got, feel free to ask them out at the end, and I'll be around as long as anyone wants to talk after this talk. So where we're going to start is with science in sports nutrition. Because in far too many cases, the science really isn't science when it comes to sports nutrition. So, for example, there's a lot of science telling us how great energy gels are, but I wondered if by completely random straw poll we could just see, does anyone here like and look forward to energy gel? Two! That's good. But not a rousing answer from everybody else. That's about what we tend to see when we do these things. And on top of that, has anybody here ever experienced a problem using energy gels in the past, whether disliking them or stomach issues, erratic energy levels? Quick show of hands, anybody? That's a fairly reasonable number there. So the science doesn't say this happens. Now, you two guys might just be the ones who got it spot on. It might work. It'd be perfectly
just
for
just
you.
Like the flavour.
Okay, did you put it on toast or did you?
It's got a black cherry yogurt flavour.
Nice. Sounds quite posh. Okay. According to the science, there are no problems. Energy gels work. They're brilliant. So let's look a little deeper at what we're dealing with. And what I want to look at is one of the most common ingredients in both sports nutrition and energy gels, which is an ingredient called maltodextrin. So what is it? If you go and try and find out what maltodextrin is, you'll be told it's a complex carbohydrate. You might be told it's a polysaccharide. Wikipedia will even tell you it's a hygroscopically sprayed freeze-dried powder. Actually, it's just a very cheap high glycemic index man-made sugar that's most commonly found in junk food like soft drinks, crisps, and ready meals. As an example of how cheap it is, if you and I were to go and buy the ingredients for an energy gel on the wholesale market, the prices we could get them, and we were buying it by the metric ton, which is about the smallest amount you could buy, the average energy gel would contain less than 1 pence of ingredients. So that's clearly a good business model, but I don't know anywhere you get good food for under 1p a serving. Generally doesn't seem to happen. Maltodextrin is not just cheap, not just popular because it's cheap. It makes labels look amazing. This is a magic trick that's completely legal. Now the deal here, this is a popular energy gel. You'll see the main ingredient is maltodextrin. And if we look on the nutrition label, we will see total carbohydrate per 32-gram serving is 25 grams. And you'll see only 5 grams of that is sugar. Would anyone here not agree that that label says that is a low-sugar product? Okay, good, good. Good to see you all awake. Well done. Now, total carbohydrate count, 25 grams. Now, the only carbohydrate sources on the label, maltodextrin and fructose. Now, we know maltodextrin is a sugar, and so is fructose. So we've got clearly 25 grams of maltodextrin and fructose, because they're the only carbohydrate sources. Yet by the time we get to the sugars, we're down to 5 grams. 20 grams of carbohydrate and sugar has just vanished. So how did that happen? Hopefully, that is our next slide. Okay, this is not from some cranky conspiracy theory weirdo website. This is from a company called Belcan, who happens to be a huge producer and supplier of maltodextrin, and this is from their website. It was put up there in 2011. I took this this screenshot today. So this is from people selling the stuff. This is not people trying to prove it's rubbish. Right. Many soft drinks and other flavored beverages contain maltodextrin in their formulas so they can have a lower amount of sugar on the nutrition facts label. On the nutrition label, maltodextrin is included under total carbohydrate instead of sugars. So we know it's a sugar. And if we can, go back. What that means is that this gel is actually 25 grams out of 32 is sugar. It's 80% sugar as opposed to the 12% you would instinctively read from the label. Like I say, nothing illegal there. That's just the way lobbying has managed to get sweeteners, many sweeteners, labeled. And sugar is the same way. So, if we go on from this, I mean, that makes sense. You're going to make it makes business sense. You're going to make this good label. It's a very cheap ingredient. Unfortunately, it's also a nutrient-negative ingredient. So maltodextrin will take more nutrients from your body than it delivers. Again, I'm not going to a cranky conspiracy theorist website. Belchem have written it for me. Maltodextrin contains almost no vitamins and minerals to assist with turning carbohydrate into energy. Therefore, consuming maltodextrin may actually reduce vitamins and minerals in the body because it uses more vitamins and minerals than it brings in. Over time, this can lead to a net decrease in a person's vitamin and mineral levels. It makes no sense that anyone should be eating this because it's going to take away more than it gives. It makes even less sense that anyone concerned with performance should be eating this. Yet there's a lot of science that tells us this is exactly what you guys, me, the rest of us, as you know, long distance runners and cyclists, is what we should be eating. Does get worse. You will find that maltodextrin, this is from the Lerner Research Institute in Ohio, contributes to the suppression of intestinal antimicrobial defense mechanisms. That is your gut bacteria responsible for your digestion and your absorption of the nutrients that you take in. It contributes to their suppression, and it may be an environmental priming factor for the development of chronic inflammatory disease. Just to be clear, a definition of chronic inflammatory disease from the US government's National Institute of Health. This includes rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, multiple sclerosis, and many others, which are a burden to humans because of lifelong debilitating illness and increased mortality. Frankly, the idea that anyone, nutritionist, company, athlete, could stand up and go, yeah, this is what you need, this is the stuff you need for performance, and then pull out science to back it up. For us, for me, for Erica, for us at 33 Shape, that sort of behaviour is not what anybody needs. It doesn't help anybody's health, it doesn't help anybody's performance, which is why it's a great pleasure to come along and just lift the lid on a few of these things tonight. It's just one example, and we could pick out a host of other ingredients and do the same thing. We've done it in our own work, and if you guys would like to know about any particular ingredients, feel free to ask later. But just as a quick one here, these are the most common ingredients in sports nutrition across the board: maltodextrin, whey protein, and fructose. They have been positively linked in studies to heart disease, multiple sclerosis, diabetes, asthma, cancer, obesity, osteoporosis, infertility, dementia. I think you get the picture. I don't need to ram it home anymore. These are junk food ingredients. The fact they're being sold at a very high markup as sports nutrition is neither here nor there. They were not transformed from junk food just because someone put them in a sports nutrition packet. So, what does all this mean for the science that tells us how good this stuff is? I mean, it's genuine science, as in it has been performed by scientists, and the published results are the genuine results of the tests that we've done. How can this work? I mean, there are two things that do skew the playing field, the two main factors that mess it up. Yeah, so the first one is publication bias. Just talking about, if all the science exists out there, how can such terrible ingredients get through? How can there be proof that they're supposed to be good for us? This was published in the British Medical Journal, Pharmaceutical Industry Sponsorship and Research Outcome. This is talking about publication bias, as in the effect of funding by a company on the results of a scientific study. And they found that systematic bias favours products which are made by the company funding the research. No huge surprise. And how do they do this? They'll do it through the selection of inappropriate comparator products. I don't know if you remember an advert from Lucozade a few years ago. Hydrate some fuels better than water. Don't know if anyone can see the slip there. Like, water is unable to fuel you, it contains no calories. We're not comparing like with like. Of course Lucozade would hydrate and fuel better than water. Water actually can't fuel you. So that's one way of doing it. And then the other great thing about Lucozade doing that, a great thing, they got that campaign banned. They got all the publicity for the campaign, then they got all the publicity for it being banned. It's devilish, but you've got to be impressed with the way they work. The other thing they can do is publication bias, that simple fact of we'll find a way to get the result we want. Well, instead of science, let's do this thing and see what happens, it's let's find this outcome and see how we can get to it. In the case of pharmaceutical industry, you can expect a 4x increase. It's 4x more likely to favour the product that has funded the study. When we get to the food industry, that rises as high as 8x more likely. So you can see where a lot of this science comes from. This gives us a raft of expert opinion backing up all of these terrible ingredients. There is now a growing body of evidence coming through as people get more conscious about their food and start to actually investigate these things. There's a growing body of evidence giving us the other side of the story, which are some of the things I've brought up today. But what this means is debate. And debate means you've got to weigh the evidence and work out which one's better, and frankly, that's a bit tiring. Everybody's busy. Do you really want to go in and be trying to work out which bit of evidence is better, which one was funded by this person, whose interest have influenced that? And this plays right into the hands of the industry, because it's a play learned from the tobacco industry, who, when the initial studies about cigarettes and cancer were coming out, their play was, and this was on a leaked internal memo from one of the big companies, doubt is our product. They were not interested in proving that cigarettes did not cause cancer. All they were interested in doing was creating doubt about whether it was proven that cigarettes did cause cancer. That causes people to get into a position where they have an internal debate. You then have to weigh up the evidence. You then have to work out what you're doing. Frankly, you're busy. The result is inertia. People keep on smoking, or in this case, athletes keep on pouring down products that are ineffective, cause problems, stack up long-term health issues, and don't do what they're meant to do. But frankly, there's quite a simple thing here. If even 20% of the evidence says something is bad for you, like really bad, peeing in a bag, unconscious, popping drugs like candy, bad for you in the long term, that's not a debate. I mean, think about it. You're going for a ride. There is a 20% chance killer bees are going to attack you on your next ride. Change the route. It's not a debate. There's a 20% chance your car is going to blow up the next time you drive it. Don't drive it. Simple. And it's the same thing here. So for us at 33 Shake, our journey is built on dealing with the real world. How do you feel? What results do you personally experience? Do you get sick less often? Are you the weight you want to be? Are you getting the recovery you want? Are all of these things happening? And the results we've had have been a knockout. Now, if we had no issues with science, we'd never have started the company. If no one else had issues with any of these products, we'd never have had a business. And instead, it's grown from something we started as a side project on our kitchen table in 2012 into a business that's now on sale in 26 countries worldwide. We've got a dedicated arm just opened up in America. Nigel Mitchell, the head of nutrition for British Cycling's Olympians, he said of one of our products, our Shake Blend, he said, it's one of the best products I've ever seen. This chap you might recognize, he's a regular customer. He now has a monthly supply of our shakes. And then someone else you may know, Chrissy Wellington, four-time World Ironman champion. She came to join us a few years ago because she loved the message, and much like us, wanted to do something to help athletes better understand for themselves ways to get healthier, fitter, faster, and stronger against the blizzard of, let's just say, unhelpful advice that is easily found out there. And the first step is really getting people to think about things and think about their own experience. So step one that we want to look at today, I know this was mentioned on the talk, weight loss techniques for performance. Okay? So whether it's post-Christmas, whether it's for a race coming up, whether it's a life goal, whatever it may be. You guys, being the audience you are going to understand the importance of power to weight ratios, so I'm not even going to begin explaining that to you now. You've got it. The other thing that I'm sure you would get, carrying too much weight is going to be a poor health marker. It's something that's going to knock you back and line you up statistically for a load of things you don't want. So how would you go about weight loss? There are three core strategies for cutting weight well as an athlete. And by well, what I mean is healthily and sustainably. And we're going to go through them in reverse order from hardest to easiest. There you go. You've got a fasting, juicing, and getting rid of animal products in your diet. Anyone ever tried fasting before? Ooh, I knew we'd have a slightly cutting edge audience here, but this is great. Okay, so for you guys, bear with me. I'll just run through it quickly. By the way, how long did anyone fast for? 24 hours, put up your hands. Okay, what about 3 days? Ooh. Five? Well, there you go, he's done 5 days and he's still here alive. Eric has done seven. the key thing about the fasting is giving your body a rest. It's also clearly going to cut the amount of calories you've got, so it's a crash on weight loss. But you think, how often our bodies are digesting pretty much our entire lives. If you can give that body a chance to rest, it's got a chance to rejuvenate, it's also going to bring the weight down, it's going to do it healthily. But you cannot look at fasting as a silver bullet. Like, if you're going to just go and crash 5 days and try and get down to a certain weight and then jump back on the bike, that's really a fast track to an eating disorder, frankly, and is not a healthy way to do it. So the best way is if you have any interest in this, look at intermittent fasting. So like the 5-2 approach that this gentleman here was mentioning, make the goal really, really achievable, okay? Make it so easy. So for example, when I started out, I went to one day of 24-hour fasting a month for 3 months. That's all. I wasn't committing to a year. I wasn't committing to a lifetime. So I'm going to try and do one day a month for 3 months. I put it in the diary, and I did Mondays. So that just meant I would finish dinner on a Sunday. I don't eat again till, well, technically I could eat Monday night, but I'd run it until Tuesday morning. Go to bed early, you're asleep, you're not eating, it's fine. Get a few extra hours. If you do want to go for the longer periods after trying it, over that 3 to 5 day period, really do your research. If necessary, see a doctor. We're not qualified to tell you about that, but go research it. If you like the idea, it's a good way of bringing weight loss down. It's a good way of resetting the body. An associate professor, University of South Florida, Dom D'Agostino, he's very big on the whole ketogenic diets and fasting. He's also a serious strength athlete himself. One of the things he adds, talk about fasting as rebooting the body. If you're over 40, cancer is one of the four diseases with an 80% certainty of killing you. Fasting can help guard against this. For me, this was kind of the tipping point that I thought, I think I want to start bringing this in. He recommends a 5 day fast 2 or 3 times a year. But if you start on that sort of goal, it's unachievable. It's like, I'm going to go, you know, I've never cycled before, I'm going to ride the Attack this year. Well, it's quite a big ask. Why not start somewhere where you can win and build up from there? Anyway, after fasting, juicing looks brilliant, like really easy, luxury. Very simple, tons of fruit and veg, chuck them in the juicer, drink those for your meals, that's it. You can have water as well. And the good thing about it is, by doing this, you are almost getting the fasting benefits because you're now removing solid food, your calories are way, way down, but because you've been juicing a load of fresh fruit and veg, and you will need to juice your own stuff, bottles are not going to work, you're getting tons of fresh nutrients straight out of that fruit and veg, so you're getting all that in, your body's getting a lot of support while it's doing this. Light training may even be possible depending on how you feel. When you're fasting, training's not really a thing for those days. So if juicing has any interest, you want to take it further, there's a brilliant documentary I'd recommend to anyone. It's called Fat, Sick and Nearly Dead. It's quite a memorable title, and it absolutely doesn't fail to deliver. It's an hour and a half, it's brilliant. Moving on, what about getting rid of animal products in your diet? So we're talking getting rid of meat, fish, dairy. This is one of the easiest ways to get rid of that stubborn bit of spare tire that just won't go no matter how much training you're doing or whatever. It needs commitment to get it done, but you don't need to stop training, and almost you don't need to eat less. Has anyone in here ever tried doing this? Oh, we've got a couple of candidates. And is it an intermittent thing? Is it a full-time thing? Yeah. And do you find results from it? Does it seem to work for you?
I do 5 and 2 every week.
5 and 2 every week? So 5 days with...
necessary.
Right, and then 2 with... That's a really good compromise. Sounds like that. And have you been doing that for long?
9 months.
Right. And was it a health thing or a performance thing? Or?
No, just a life health thing.
Well, I think it's similar to the fasting, to make it an easy win if you fancy doing this. You know, you could do it the other way around. You could just do 2 days a week. And you just need to watch. There's a lot of, if you do this for the first time, there's a lot of easy cheats out there. There's a lot of vegan junk food. And if you're just eating, vegetarian sausages and chips, you're still eating sausages and chips. It's not really going to do much for you. You need to be kind of making all the stuff yourself and working off fruits, vegetables, beans, rice, seeds, that kind of stuff. So if you are following any of these and you're looking to get the weight down, I'm sure you guys will be familiar with these things, so we'll do them quickly. Landmines to avoid, the biggest things that will derail you. Soft drinks and any calories that you drink are going to be a major problem. Such an easy way to pile calories on, same as the salad dressing. Get the salad, cover it in a creamy, sugary dressing full of God knows what. That also means all processed foods are out, as are processed sports nutrition products, And the low-fat and no-fat sugar or low-fat, no-fat or low-sugar, no-sugar products, because every single one of those, when the supposed bad stuff came out, well, they had to replace it with something so it didn't taste like cardboard, and what goes back in is preservative and sweetener, which is worse for you. That applies to diet sodas, the whole thing. Okay, so they're gone. We're going to move on to the exciting subject, of protein. Now, we'll probably do a whole day on this, but we'll not. I'm going to keep it short. How does protein fit into an athletic diet, and particularly how does it fit if you're removing animal products? What's going to happen there? The good news I have for you is that you are all getting enough protein already without doing anything particular to get it. In the UK, the average woman is already consuming 74 grams of protein a day, while the average man is doing 90. This is near double recommended daily amounts. Now, if you were training, you'd be looking for a gram per kilo of body weight. That's your standard formula, just to keep yourself on point. Now, I'm 75 kilos. The average man in the UK is eating 90 kilos. That's already my 1 gram per kilo of body. He's eating 90 grams of protein a day. That's already my one gram per kilo, plus a bit of spare change to help me out. And this is dealing with average people, not focused cyclists like yourself or people who are particularly bothered about their diet. Think about the average diet in the UK. Not terrible, not great. You know, and that already has enough protein. So the idea that you need to go find more is not true. What is much more important is quality. Okay, it's the quality of your protein. And the first place you get the best quality of the protein is in your daily diet. One of the things Chrissy Wellington, the multiple Ironman world champion, said to us when we first met is that her sports nutrition is her daily diet. You know, it's easy to think this is what I eat, this is my sports nutrition. It's all part of exactly the same thing. Everything you eat is going to affect how you recover, how you perform, how you refuel, how your immune function works, all of those things. So look for the whole food protein sources first, whether that is going to be from animal products, meat, fish, dairy, or whether it's going to be from beans, nuts, legumes, pulses. Bear in mind, there is protein in every piece of whole food. Like the cow, i.e. steak, only has protein because he ate the grass. You're getting it secondhand. Now, I'm not suggesting we all go and eat grass, but what I am saying is if you eat a salad, it does contain some protein. Oats, 14% protein. That's just in a bowl of porridge before you add any milk. Steak is only 22%. You know, so your food has a lot of protein in it. Go with quality whole foods and you're going to be getting it. The one to avoid if you do want to use a supplementary product is whey protein. Anyone here ever used any whey protein lately? Good. I used it in the past, and the reason to avoid it, it's a dairy product. It's not just a dairy product, it's an industrial dairy product. If we look back at the history of whey protein, well, what was whey? Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet with her curds and whey. It's a byproduct of cheese production that the dairy industry used to have to pay to get rid of because it polluted rivers. Then they worked out, hang on, this isn't working. Let's feed it to the cows because it's cheaper than cattle feed. So they did that. Then someone thought, I wonder if people would eat it, and they did some studies, and what do you know, it's amazing for rebuilding muscles. Bingo, athletes pay a lot more than cows for whey protein, promise you that much. And that's been a great business ever since. There's a whole report you can read if you're as geeky about this as me, which is quite literally called Turning Waste into Gold, I think. It's a report on the protein industry in Australia. Anyway, point is, powdered down processed whey powder. First of all, it's not food. It's so far removed from a piece of food by the time it's been turned into a powder. A lot of additives, a lot of sugar, a lot of sweeteners. But if we're looking at where industrial dairy comes from, it comes from unhealthy animals. They are stressed. On top of that, they're kept in unsanitary conditions. They're fed a lot of antibiotics and hormones, A, to keep them alive and producing milk in those conditions, close quarters. All of that ends up in your dairy products. That is absolutely going to be in your whey protein. So several major studies show strong links between dairy consumption and cancer. These have been done since the 1970s, and they have a particular focus on prostate cancer. So for all of us gentlemen here, that's reason enough. Make sure the whey protein is no whey protein. Thank you very much. I'll be here all night. I do the mitzvahs, weddings, and all. So, I mean, I know there's a bit of a theme in here, benefits of plant stuff over animal products, but in everything we've done and researched at 33 Shape, all paths keep coming back to the same place for serious, sustained endurance performance that you can build off and keep going with. A predominantly plant-based diet is a very good way to go. Are any real athletes doing this sort of thing, though, really? I mean, it's all very well going to your vegan restaurant in Soho and having some hummus, but what about someone who's out there on the front lines? Well, David Hay, world heavyweight champion, there you go, he's completely plant-based. This guy, Rich Roll, I don't know if you come across him, he is 52 years old, and Men's Fitness had him down as one of the fittest men on the planet. He's an ultra-endurance athlete doing swim-run races like the Otillo and long-distance triathlon. This man, Brendan Brazier, he's a former professional Ironman, and as he said, I just couldn't resist putting this quote in, "I'm sure protein deficiency is going to set in any day now, but I've managed to avoid it for the first 27 years of being vegan." Doesn't seem to be giving him too much trouble. Now, on the subject of muscles, muscle loss with age. Age is coming to all of us, and apparently, over the age of 40, forget it, muscles are going to vanish. We're all going to turn into Walter the Softy, get sand kicked in our face by the big boys. The only way we could possibly avoid that, thank heavens the protein industry exists, they will sell us protein that will stop this happening. What they have missed, that's what it's called. That's the actually, even the technical name for this is nasty. It's called age-related sarcopenia. It sounds very frightening. Why would it be the age of 40? First of all, this is a typical point for the midlife crisis, right? And if you were a protein company and you wanted to expand sales out of the 25 to 35-year-old gym-going bracket and into the even more affluent 35 to 50-year-old professional bracket, I know this is a pretty handy story to tell, just saying. But who are we looking at here? When you look at the studies, it's the average population again. And, well, if we look at modern life, people sit down a lot. The average person doesn't really do any sport. They don't have a great diet. So if you've spent your life on the sofa watching Strictly and your idea of exercise is lifting 7 pints every Friday night, you're not going to have ever put on any muscle. You're going to have been losing muscle from the age of about 19. By the time you're 40, you're going to be so far down the hill that you're just going to have to look at the pie shop to put on weight. And there's an example. So the problem with this is it's sort of become accepted wisdom that, well, we're all going to lose muscle over 40, so why bother training? And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's this sort of placebo effect that we need to get up against, because the story we believe in our minds is what has the most powerful effect on our lives and our performance. You need the right story when it comes to age-related muscle loss, and the right story is muscle mass loss over 40 is reserved for lazy buggers with shoddy diets. It's optional and completely avoidable. So we're going to look at one of my favourite examples here. I absolutely love this slide. So here we have a young active 23-year-old. What these are is MRI scans. So if you imagine chopping off the top of your leg and looking down on the top of the leg. So here is a 23-year-old, young active 23-year-old on the left, and we look at the untrained 82-year-old, he's lost muscle. Cause and effect, get old, lose muscle, must be true, but hang on a minute. What about the 74-year-old cyclist next to him who appears to have the same amount of muscle as the 23-year-old? Well, how did that happen? He told himself a different story and he kept cycling. He's probably one of these walnut coloured blokes you see going up outdoors every morning. And then cross-country skier, 91 on the right. The point is, muscle wastage over 40 is completely unnecessary. You're getting enough protein already. Keep going out on your bike and going to the gym. And just to hang on this. Don't know if anyone's ever come across this guy, Charles Eugster. Sadly passed away last year at the age of 98, I believe. A master's athlete. He has a fabulous TED talk. Look it up on YouTube. It's called Why Bodybuilding at 93 Years Old is a Great Idea. And in his own words, he said, this is him at about, I guess, 93, 94. In his own words, he said, I'm very vain. I didn't like what I saw in the mirror, and I wanted to pick up all the hot 70-year-old chicks. Very interesting. You know, what's the story you want to tell yourself? Go off it. So, yeah. Putting it all together, at that 33 show, we totally reject the idea that elite athletes are, by definition, unhealthy, that health and high performance are incompatible. Because if we accept that, we're accepting a ceiling on the top end of performance, right? And at 33 Shake, we totally don't buy that. Our ethos is about unlocking that barrier. Because actually bringing, you know, you can't have extreme performance without extreme health. And if you do, you're gonna have it for a very, very short window of time before the health issues catch up with you. Bringing those two things together, huge health plus huge performance, is the biggest game going for any athlete at any age, at any level. And we want to unlock that. Now, if we are right about all this, though, why are there a huge number of professional elite athletes eating the very things we say are so terrible and doing the very things we say are going to result in an early bath? There are two core reasons of this. And the first part is, well, they're paid to use it. And they use it a lot less than you would ever imagine. As an example, I was fortunate enough to cycle with Chris Hoy at the Velodrome. He has named after him in Scotland. It was for an event years ago when I was a journalist, and the event was put on by Science in Sport. You may have heard of them. And after the event, Chris Hoy was out on track all day as journalist after journalist, went and did a few laps with him and did an interview as we went round, and he taught us how to do various things. I mean, he was literally on autopilot, but lovely, lovely man. But at the end, one of the Science in Sport people came up to him and said, Chris, here's your recovery package, and gave him like a package of Science in Sport nutrition. And he said, very polite, thank you very much, and he gave it to his assistant, who put it in a bag and then pulled a chicken sandwich out of the bag and gave him the chicken sandwich. Now, this is a snapshot. For all I know, Chris Hoy went home and bathed in Science in Sport products. I have no idea. But then what I saw is he didn't use them. He went for real food. Chrissy Wellington backs up the same thing. A number of other athletes have backed it up as well. Of course, you're going to have the bottle out for the cameras and you're going to do this, but the use that elite athletes put these products to is fractional compared to the use that is sold off the back of that, as in you need it for every single ride and every minute and every training session. But another part of this is habit. So a lot of professional athletes have come up through an education system that will have taught them nutrition at some point. Now, if they've reached the top of their career, the early start of that is going to be at least 10 years ago. So it's out of date when it got to them. But both they and their coaching staff are reluctant to make significant change because they have something that works. Now, the example I put out here, both Phil and Jules have said to me that it's similar with elite cyclists, many of whom have horrible bike fit. Yet will they change it? No, they'd rather, you know, have numb areas they don't want, inefficiencies they don't need, because it works. And they'll have to go through a process of breaking down and coming back up, and they might not be as quick when they come back. So there's that going on with the nutrition side as well. We're going to look next at testosterone. Valuable for men and for women. Men just need a bit more of it. It's a key hormone for health and performance. Helps mood, libido, and the maintenance and development of lean muscle mass. So it's a key marker that we all want to look after, particularly as we're getting older. Supplies do fall naturally with age, and this is reversible. So how would we do this naturally? You can inject it. In America, all you have to do is go to your doctor, get a test, and they'll say, oh, you're deficient, and bingo, you've got a prescription. The one small problem with this is testosterone works in combination with a number of other hormones. If you're injecting it, that may actually just as well set the whole system out of balance as having a lower level in the first place. So you fix one thing and broken another. Instead, you can raise the levels naturally. It's a lot cheaper, you don't have to go to America, and you don't have to spike yourself like a pincushion. How would we do it naturally? You're going to reduce stress. If you take nothing away from this other than that, this is the biggest one. All the training gains and good diet in the world are going to count for nothing if you're stressed off your nut, because that is going to bring your testosterone right down. So, it basically, think of kryptonite for your testosterone. You're going to bring stress down, and everything else, the other 4 points really go around that. Awesome sleep. What do we mean by that? We're talking good sleep hygiene. This is regular bedtime, regular wake time. This means that when life intervenes, whether it's parties, children, deadlines at work, travel, whatever it is, you try and top up with a power nap whenever you can. And by that, I mean the minimum effective dose. That has generally been proven to be 20 minutes. So if you've missed a few hours, if you can just get 20 minutes of sleep, that's enough to go through one sleep cycle and help top up what you've lost. Meditation. So we are getting woo-woo here. We'll be sitting under crystals next, whatever. Huge benefits in helping rewire the brain, bring down stress, help better sleep, increase immune function. Completely free and really, really easy. I struggled for ages to get going with it, and then began using an app called Headspace. There are many other apps. I've just found this one very valuable. But literally, meditation sounds difficult. Sit down, close your eyes, think about your breath. Get distracted, come back to your breath again. Get distracted, come back to your breath again. At the end of 5 minutes, you're done. You are meditating. That's it in 30 seconds. And you want to try and boost zinc, magnesium, antioxidants, and good fats in the diet. So all of these are going to help with testosterone production. The antioxidants are going to bring down some of that internal damage caused by hard stress, whether it's physical or life and work stress. And the good fats are going to help the testosterone production to keep moving. Foods that you could use for covering these various things: pomegranates, raw cacao, coconut in all forms. What have we got here? Virgin olive oil, chia seeds, pumpkin seeds. Again, we're getting to a good whole food diet. And then the next one. Don't worry, we're not going to go through every single hormone here. We're just going to do two. We're going to go with cortisol. Because cortisol is basically our big stress hormone. And if we get the same problems when we get too little testosterone, we've got a problem. When we've got too much cortisol, we've got a problem. They kind of go hand in hand. The problem with cortisol, again, it's catabolic. Okay, anabolic, building muscle; catabolic, breaking muscle down. All of your great gains out the window because you got stressed or didn't get enough sleep or whatever. So we're going to be back to the same thing. Well, CTFO, that is tech speak for chill the out. Okay. That's an umbrella for what you want to do here. Again, we're back to the sleeping. We're talking the sleep hygiene, keeping the room dark, no screens before bedtime, no devices in the bedroom, by which I mean phones and things. Whatever you do behind closed doors is entirely your own business. Meditation again. Avoid stressful food. What does that mean? It's not food that shouts at you. Effectively, we're talking about processed food. We're talking about high sugar food. We're talking about junk food. That stuff is going to put more stress into the body in exactly the same way that eating more plants and fresh whole foods is going to reduce that stress in the body. So this is going to help you absorb your training stress. It's going to help you maximize your gains. Add adaptogens. What exactly are adaptogens? They're naturally occurring substances that occur in a number of fruits and vegetables and a few other things. They help the body adapt to changing stress, whatever it may be. They're very good for these things. Some examples of those, I'm sure I had some on here. There you go, yeah, reishi mushrooms and cordyceps. Yeah, they're not exactly the kind of thing you're going to suddenly go and find in Tesco. I see someone nodding there. Have you got some reishi mushroom and cordyceps with you, sir?
Not with me, but it's all happening on it.
You're on it. Good man, aren't you? I thought there'd be some of that with this crowd. Phil and George did warn me it would be a far higher educated than average crowd, and you've absolutely not disappointed at all. reishi mushroom, cordyceps, they're just mushroom extracts. Funnily enough, you can find them in our shakes along with other things, but there are plenty of other suppliers and you could just buy them online. Right, we're now going to come to burning fat, which is the real bedrock of all of your aerobic performance, okay? It's going to be the least stressful, most powerful way to get the maximum out of all of your cycling and your aerobic training. So what's this man running across the desert got to do? This man is called Sebastian Chenieux. He is one of the coolest ultra runners in the world of ultra running. And I first met him at a race in 2009. It was a 100-mile race going through the Alps with 10,000 vertical meters between start and finish. and a 50% finish rate. And understandably, I was a little nervous. And I met him, and I said, because obviously he's done this a lot before, I said, what do you eat for something like this? And I was in the very early stages of my sports nutrition journey. I was still doing what the nutrition companies told me, using all these products. I expected he would say, oh, well, I have this gel every this many minutes. I have that powder every that many minutes. Every 2 hours, my crew give me this. And instead, he just said that. You must listen to your body. Give it what it needs. And that illustrates several things. One, he was supremely fat adapted and had this great aerobic engine to work from and this reliable energy source to go from. And on top of that, the body gives you a lot of signals when it needs food, when it needs water, otherwise we'd all be dead. And he'd learned to tune into those at a very high level. That way, he was always on top of the nutrition just by listening to it. So how do we maximize our ability to access stored fat? Let's hope there is actually a slide here. Very good. First one, train fasted. By training in a fasted state, this doesn't mean you have to go and do a week without eating, but let's just say you went out for a ride before breakfast. You're training with no food on board. This is going to force the body to start accessing those fat reserves, which is going to encourage it to do that more often. Now, why would we be interested in this? Two reasons. One, burning fat is far less stressful on the body. It causes far less internal reaction and stress, therefore you're able to get more from your training. Most importantly, it will fuel you forever. Like, you can fill up your carbohydrate tank, and you know, much as you've eaten, that'll last for 2 hours. Fat tank will go for days, albeit at a slightly lower intensity, but if you follow these simple methods, you can raise the level at which you are predominantly burning fat, which means you need to take less nutrition on board and become more efficient and happier into the bargain. So training fasted is a good way to start it. Reduce processed carbs in your diet. This means, like, the more processed carbs you have, the more the body sees them as a go-to, the less it goes and accesses stored fat. Increase good fats. It's the reverse of the same process. So we're talking olive oil, avocados, nuts, seeds, coconut oil, that sort of thing. Increase this in your diet, and what do you know? The body increasingly begins to see fat as a great fuel source. Start slow. Rather than going out and trying to smash that first KOM or Strava segment, as soon as you get on the bike, 15 minutes conversational pace just eases the body in, doesn't cause it to bang straight over to the red line when it goes, stuff this, just pour the carbs on. Okay, just give the body a chance to get going. Right. So this guy, Phil Maffetone, if you are interested in looking further into fat burning and the methods of it, he used to train a guy called Mark Allen, who's a six-time World Ironman champion. Phil Maffetone is basically the man when it comes to all things fat burning and endurance. He's incredible. And one of the things he said, a single meal or snack of refined carbohydrate can turn off fat burning, can significantly disturb hormones, and it can switch on the genes that cause disease. Now, this doesn't mean that if you eat a Mars bar, you're suddenly going to die. But what it does mean is, in terms of your performance and your overall diet, prioritizing fats over carbs is a very good way to build that base and go forward. So we're back to Sebastian Chenillot, because this all falls under the bracket of listening to your body. And what we're going to look at next, unbelievably, one nutrition strategy that works for any race, any time, any person, any distance. So having spent ages saying there's no silver bullet and you shouldn't believe anything that nutrition companies tell you, I'm now going to try and sell you this. Let's give it a go. First thing, throw away scheduled nutrition plans. And I expect a lot of you don't use them already because you're at a much higher level. Point is, a scheduled nutrition plan exists to sell product. Case in point, there are most, if not all, gel manufacturers will recommend you take a gel on the start line. Now, if we just skip back, Phil Maffetone, where's he gone? Oh, it's gone. There we go. Okay. A single meal or snack of refined carbohydrate can turn off fat burning. Let's forget the rest. All you got to do, that scheduled nutrition plan, it says you need to have a gel on the start line. At that point, you are now turning off your body's ability to fuel from stored fat. What you're going to do in that case is be 100% dependent on carbohydrate. You will be the bloke who needs a gel every 30 minutes. You will be the bloke who looks like he has a shopping trolley stuffed in his shirt pockets, okay? Because you won't be able to access the stored fat at all. If you ever wanted proof that the scheduled nutrition plans are not there for you, that is it. They're there to sell product. And that's why the recommendations only ever go up in terms of consumption, never down. There are shareholders these companies have to look after all. Know your average intervals. So all I mean by this is, when you go and ride, how often, roughly, do you need to eat something? Is it every 45 minutes? Is it once an hour? You're going to know roughly what this interval is. So with that figure in mind, there's your starting point, okay? And if you don't have one, start at 45 minutes. That will do just fine. And all we're going to do is, when that time comes around, 45 minutes, I should probably eat. Let's get rid of the word probably. Let's just say, am I hungry? Take a beat. Yes, I'm hungry. Oh, I think I'll eat something. Done. I'm now going to wait another 45 minutes and I'm going to ask myself the same question again. But I'm not hungry. I'm going to wait 10 minutes then. In 10 minutes, I'm going to ask myself a question again. Am I hungry? No. Keep going. Now, frankly, you might find you go 4 hours and eat nothing, and that really is completely natural. Your body doesn't want anything. It's fine. You might find at other times you're eating every 10 minutes. And again, that's fine too. It's what you need. But as long as you're asking this question, you're now responding to hunger. And if you get used to scheduling that check-in interval, then you're never either behind or ahead with your nutrition. You've never taken too much, you've never taken too little, and you've always got, let's say you haven't eaten for 3 hours, well, you know that in 10 minutes you're going to check in with yourself. So you're not going to get to a point where you're going to run out. And as you do this, you will learn all the signals that your body gives you when it gets hungry. And brilliantly, you will be on top of your nutrition the entire time. You can do exactly the same for hydration. Just bear in mind the confusing statistic that in a recent study, 62% I think of people were unable to tell the difference between being hungry and being thirsty, because the symptoms are really similar. Fortunately, as athletes, you're already much more likely to be in the 38% who do actually have a clue when they're hungry or thirsty. And as long as you've got a good diet and you're using this check-in strategy, you can't really go wrong. So, what's there another? There you go. Yeah, so you just extend and contract your check-in intervals as required. And as you do this, practice in training, never try anything new on race day, you will build a strategy that will work for any race, for any person, any time, any distance, any weather, because it's now completely personalized to you. Last one we're going to do, I think, is getting rid of stomach trouble. Now, if you are eating an awesome diet, you're not being taken out by dodgy sports nutritionists, you're keeping your cortisol and testosterone in fine order, you're burning fat at maximum efficiency, and you're fueling to what your body requires, not to a schedule that someone else has given you, you should basically never ever feel ill again. But that's a bit like saying, well, you've been riding a bike a long time, you're never going to fall off it again. Might not work that way. So they go wrong occasionally. How are we going to get rid of stomach trouble? First thing, hydration. The body's moving around, all the blood is diverted away from digestion, your ability to digest when you're exercising is significantly reduced. By keeping the body well hydrated, it's like keeping oil in the car. That just allows the digestion process, it gives it a hand. So, any problems, keep on the water. What else? Go for whole fuel sources. Now, ideally, if you're feeling a bit sick, a pint of maltodextrin is probably not going to help. Even if some of the advice says, oh, you know, you just need to train your stomach. No, like if you're smacking your head against the wall and it hurts, the answer is not to smack your head against the wall more. It's to not smack it against the wall. And what else have we got? Use the check-in strategy, so you've got that. That's the strategy I was referring to in the last slide. You're eating and drinking to hunger and thirst. Time your breakfast. A lot of things written about race day breakfast and training breakfast. Key thing to remember is the word breakfast. It's really just breakfast. Like, eat what you like for breakfast. Whatever you normally eat, eat that. Give yourself an hour to 2 hours before starting exercise if you can, you know, particularly if you're going into a race where you know you're going to be going hard quite quickly. You may find, I'm sure you'll have your own experience with training rides, what does and doesn't work for you. So we don't need to really go over that for ages. And I think that is pretty much not. Look at that. That is the most amazing energy gel in the world. Made by this company. 33 shake, and apparently it's powerful, it's delicious, stable energy, no stomach trouble. The other product we made, the one that Bradley Wiggins is using and the one that Nigel Mitchell was so excited by, is our pre and post workout shake blend. It's 33 individual superfoods, including reishi mushroom and cordyceps and a number of those other things that you need, all in one handy blend.
Thank you for the presentation, very interesting, and also thank you for not plugging your shake,
your gel. Let me go back a slide.
But now I want to give you the chance to sort of plug your gels by explaining why they're different, how you would use them, what's different about them compared to, say, a cyst gel or a torque gel, or what's, why is it different? And
so the difference with our energy gel, the whole ethos behind our products comes from, essentially, if we boil it down, we know a bowl of salad is probably good for us and a bowl of sweets is not. And if we look at the ingredients in traditional sports nutrition, well, it's all the stuff that's in the bowl of sweets. So why do we need that when we want the best from ourselves? How do we create a whole food energy gel? The first difference is we don't use a single ingredient anyone else uses. So if you look at every gel out there, it's maltodextrin, fructose, acesulfame K, potassium sorbate, and possibly brown rice syrup. That's effectively it. There is no difference. I don't care whether you're hunting the bargain bins for high five or whether you're paying premium for talk. Same. We use chia seeds, Himalayan pink salt, coconut palm sugar, and raw vanilla. And that combination, it comes in a little gel packet and it's dry. So that's the first thing. You then need to add the water to it, because at that point the chia seeds absorb the water and create your gel naturally over a 10-minute period. The reason we had to keep the chia seeds whole is because you've got so many good fats and proteins in there that are lost when you grind and powder it. So at every point, how do we get the maximum out of the ingredients? You've got natural anti-inflammatories in there to take away the stress of training while you're doing it. You've got a little bit of natural electrolyte from the Himalayan pink salt, which is the cleanest salt you can get anywhere. And you're getting protein, carbohydrate, you're getting a little bit of carbohydrate in quickly from the coconut palm sugar, which is a low GI, high mineral sugar. And then you're getting protein and fats from the chia seeds. Now, you could also change these gels up. You can add water, that's a standard blend. You could add coffee, you want a caffeine gel. A number of cyclists do it. It was Italian cyclists who first put us onto that one. You can add fruit juice if you want to turn up a carb. You could add coconut water for extra hydration, and you don't need to make them while you're riding. Don't imagine we're thinking, it's like gel out, pack it off the bottle while you're riding. You make them in advance on the day you need them or the night before. They last for 24 hours when prepared. So at every stage, it's not like any other gel in any sense. It's whole food. It delivers, instead of that sugar spike and crash, you've got a bit of a ramp up of the coconut palm sugar before the chia seeds then come in. As the body digests them, there's that fiber in there, that's going through. As it's broken down, the water that the chia absorbed is also released. And that naturally is going to help regulate the hydration during the digestion process. Some people have said, oh yeah, fiber in gels, that's a bad idea. There's a lot of evidence saying that it is. Funnily enough, a lot of that evidence is from people who make gels with no fiber in them. Just saying. What we know is that I've used them for 48 hours and beyond. We had an athlete do a 2,000 kilometer solo triathlon in 12 days, exclusively using those in our shakes. We've never had a single person have any issue with the fiber other than a benefit. There's loads of reviews on the website rather than having to listen to me anymore. But thank you for giving me the opportunity for that. I shall cut it there. Anyone wants to know any more about our products, feel free to ask me.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.